Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two segments today. In moments, Wilson Sherwin will talk about anti-work politics through the lens of the welfare rights movement from nearly 50 years ago. And at the bottom of the hour, Marta Silva Cabral and Forrest Hilton look at Brazil on the eve of Bolsonaro's inauguration. First, work and its discontents. Antun Yeager was on this show recently to offer a critique of anti- or post-work politics, whose modern version has its roots in the Italian Autonomia movement of the 1970s, though it does have a rich history on the Marxist and anarchist left besides that. Here is a different point of view from Wilson Sherwin, a graduate student at the City University of New York, who's writing a dissertation on the welfare rights movement of the late 60s and early 70s. Members of that movement were enthusiastic advocates of the take-this-job-and-shove-it line. Wilson is also active in the grad student union at CUNY. Wilson Sherwin.
Before I repress the record button, Wilson, we were talking about how this conversation around work or anti-work or post-work politics often operates at an extremely high level of abstraction. You are approaching this from a much more concrete point of view. So help us be more rooted in our conversation. What's a good way to start thinking about it?
So I think one of the problems with anti-work politics, both the criticisms of it and the advocates of it, is that they really silence the history of working class anti-work politics. And so my work tries to really recenter this. I'm writing a dissertation about the welfare rights movement, which was a movement of welfare recipients in the 60s and 70s who were active at a time when the solutions that most social movements were putting forward were full employment, jobs, 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 or the Equal Rights Amendment for, you know, the mainstream women's movement. And the welfare rights activists looked at this and said, we don't want work. Work is not the thing that is ever going to save the working class. It's the thing that actually has institutionalized our poverty. What we want is income decoupled from employment. Going back and really looking at the way they construct both their analysis of work and their sort of vision for the future could help us really ground what we mean when we talk about anti-work politics.
Where I stumble on this sort of thing is that what would make that kind of income possible is somebody else's work. You have to have a society full of people producing stuff in order to have an income be worth anything. So how does that work out?
I think that part of it is thinking about what we really want. And Roland Simon, who's a French communist who was really active in the 90s when there was another big upsurge of anti-work politics in France, describes anti-work politics as the demand that work be neither the condition nor the center of our lives. So maybe we could think of it as sort of saying, our main preoccupation is figuring out how to get people what they need, not insisting that they have a job in order to get it.
Well, this is one thing that happens, that we collapse job and work. Humans have to labor to remain alive. Without some kind of labor, we'll be dead. But then we need to think about how we want to organize that essential labor, don't we?
Sure, yes. 100 years ago, we needed the vast majority of the population to be laboring in agriculture in order to provide us with enough food to live. And because of technological advancements, we no longer need that, right? We have the means in order to provide people with food without everyone being a farmer. Maybe if we think of anti-work politics as the aspiration to have the amount of time that people need to spend laboring in order to meet their material needs be reduced as much as possible, rather than this kind of airy-fairy abolition of work entirely.
Now, that's an agenda I can embrace. Yes.
Absolutely.
Barbara Ehrenreich once said years ago, workers of the world, relax.
Yes.
Which I found very charming and also very persuasive. Also, before I hit the record button, you were discussing the history of the discourse around work slavery in the American working class movement. Talk about that some.
One of the important American and certainly international kind of long lineages of critiques of labor was this notion of thinking about work as waged slavery, right? And this was so prevalent in 19th century America, for example, that during the discussions of the abolition of chattel slavery, people who were pro-slavery were sort of so indignant, like, how do you even distinguish between what's slavery and what's wage slavery? Like, what's next? Are you guys going to say there's no work? How can you even tell? I mean, white workers in the North probably have worse living standards than a lot of our slaves, right? To them, it was like this total collapsing of, well, people are laboring. You want to abolish one form of this and not the other? Like, are you going to do away with everything? And the notion of wage slavery as a deeply oppressive institution that one should challenge and attempt to do away with to the extent possible was so resonant to the working class in the U.S. especially, that when the 13th Amendment came about, right, which not only did away with chattel slavery, but also has this clause of any sort of involuntary labor, that the labor movement, at least the kind of militant rank and file, really seized upon this as having big liberatory potential for them. And it was, in fact, then labor bureaucrats who had to squash this and say, no, 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 that's not how we're going to frame our demands. This is way too radical. This is way too much. Like, chill with this wage slavery stuff and your aspiration that the 13th Amendment might in some way give you the right to live without involuntary servitude. That's just going to be the nature of our lives.
There's a critique of anti-work politics that says that by making work the enemy or fantasizing the elimination of work, one is giving up on the possibilities of reordering production, reorganizing the nature of work. Is that a fair rap?
No, and I think it's a really interesting kind of denial of such an important part of Marxism, which, you know, he famously argued that surplus population was the lever of accumulation, right? And I think that this is a really key part of why something like a universal basic income is appealing, in the sense, right, one of my favorite explanations of it is as a permanent strike fund. Right. I think that we can conceive of anti-work politics and critique of work and moving towards a society in which people have income decoupled from their labor as actually being ways of really empowering workers, those who are in the labor force, and also ideally of really reimagining how production takes place in general. So really giving people the option of an exit. And if people are, you know, leaving certain industries or certain jobs in droves, of having to really have a conversation, a political debate over what is produced and how do we make it so that people want to do this thing or agree to do this thing that we say is necessary, or if we decide that something is really unnecessary, to figure out a different way to do it.
Yeah, I was going to say that there are a lot of unpleasant tasks that people have to be more or less forced into doing under the present arrangement, and this would force us to rethink how those unpleasant tasks are approached and performed.
Absolutely, right? It's not just, Gilles Dauvet says this, it's not just who's going to pick up the garbage, but it's also a broader question of, like, what is the garbage that we're producing, and how are we getting rid of it? And, right, a real way that I think anti-work politics might allow us the means to reconceive of what we're producing and how and why, and does it really need to be produced, and should something else be happening instead, not just co-managing the pile, as Solanas would say.
Yeah, let's talk a bit more about the welfare rights movement, which I think is probably almost totally forgotten today. Who were these women? Where'd they organize? What were their demands? What did it look like? And what years were these?
The welfare rights movement really came about between 1966 and the early 70s. Like, up, they were really active up through basically 72, 73. Mostly black women, obviously poor women, many of whom had worked as domestics, had worked in agriculture, who for some reason or another, either because they became mothers and it was impossible for them to balance their terrible low-wage jobs with motherhood, or because of injuries, got on welfare, and partially inspired by a lot of civil rights activism, realized that they could come together and make demands. One of their big demands was doing away with the really insidious, invasive policies like man-in-the-house rules, which left them open to these midnight raids that welfare offices would conduct to see if, for example, you had slippers in the house that might belong to a man, because that would clearly be evidence that that man should be providing for your children. They wanted to do away with these problematic policies, but they also made the demand very quickly that more work and better work was not going to meet their needs. What their slogan was, more money now.
The jobs that these women had or likely to have were truly terrible, right? Like, very low-end service work, domestic work, low wages, no prospects, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the work that they were then, you know, being forced into, because this was also right at the advent of a lot of work requirements being attached to welfare, were things that they felt that they were already doing. So taking care of children, working as domestics, right? Working in childcare centers.
It's productive if you're working for somebody else, right?
But exactly.
If you work for yourself, it's not productive.
Exactly. Like, these are things that we feel we should be able to do in our own homes, not be forced to do in someone else's home. But they also have a much more nuanced and complicated understanding of this, because the way that a lot of historians have read the welfare rights movement, even those who are really sympathetic to it, has been to say, okay, well, they're sort of attached to this atavistic notion of women in the home, right? They just wanted to be middle-class housewives, basically.
And that rubbed a lot of second-wave feminists the wrong way at that time, right?
Absolutely. They don't realize that the way that we are going to be liberated is by going into the workforce. They just want to go back to this past where women are allowed to stay home with their children. And this is said really explicitly. Even there was a...
Now, is this like professional class feminists who thought, I'm going to be a professor or a doctor, not that I'm going to be a toilet scrubber?
Betty Friedan was not going to be scrubbing someone's toilet.
Right.
In her sort of fantasy of work as liberation. But in 1968, there was a congressional hearing on income maintenance where the self-proclaimed biggest feminist in office said exactly this to Beulah Sanders and Jeanette Washington and all of these welfare rights activists who came down to testify, where she said, if you're not going to work, you're just going to be stuck at home and you're going to be excluded from productive society. And they said very explicitly, they responded to her saying, actually, that's not at all how we conceive of this. We don't think of ourselves as going back into the home. We think that we have more important tasks to do. And what our task is, what our really valuable contribution to society, is not necessarily caretaking or staying in our homes. It's the political work that we're doing in our communities. And I think that that's a really important intervention into this whole conversation of, well, what do we conceive of the kind of alternative to either being stuck in the home, which we have rejected rightfully, feminists have rejected rightfully for generations now, or being forced into a deeply unfulfilling job that is not going to resolve our primary problem, which is poverty.
Well, I bet the congresswoman who was saying that had somebody cleaning her toilet at home.
Oh, absolutely. And taking care of her children. Right?
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah. So how did they come together? How did they organize?
Well, they organized a lot in very small local collectives. There were over 600 across the country, a lot of them based in New York. Over half were based in New York. Partially, they came about sort of organically, spontaneously, in response to having really negative interactions in welfare offices. Many of these women had experience organizing either, some had been in unions in their past, some had been part of the civil rights movement, and sort of figured out that they could get access to, for example, the welfare policy books and learn the policy better than the caseworkers and assert their rights to things like, there were a lot of special needs grants available at the time. So there were sort of lists of a standard that a house should be up to, right? You should have a certain number of plates for every person. There should be a couch. There should be a winter coat for every child, right? And if you didn't have these, you could get a special grant. And the kind of realization that there
This is when the New York City system was very generous by current standards.
Absolutely, right? It was during the war on poverty, so there was a real sense of And a fear because of all of the riots during the civil rights, right, of how do we quell this? Well, maybe we do it by giving people more money. And in 1 month alone in Brooklyn, these women managed to get over $13 million in 1968 dollars, which is close to $100 million now, right, in these special grants. And so the sort of realization of these special grants and that as a tactic flooded the movement and gave it a kind of cohesion. And then the imposition of all of these really onerous work requirements gave them real sort of fodder for thinking through, well, what is work? What do we aspire to? From which they developed these big critiques of labor and really asserted that that work was fundamentally problematic.
The work requirements, aside from their Calvinist angle, are also, it sounds like they're intended to suppress their political activity.
Absolutely, which has been a major function of wage labor throughout capitalism.
And their techniques for making these demands are very disruptive, right?
Mm-hmm.
What did they do?
Occupying these welfare centers and government offices was one of their big tactics. Sitting in these welfare offices until they got the checks that they wanted and having people say, oh, sorry, no, there's just nothing we can do, nothing we can do. And basically sort of holding these caseworkers hostage until they got the checks that they believed they were entitled to.
I'm speaking with Wilson Sherwin, who's studying the welfare rights movement of the late 1960s and early 1970s and its relevance to anti-work politics today.
Now, this draft paper you've written with Fran Piven, you talk about them as feminist in a way, but forgotten by feminism, right? What happened? Why is feminism forgotten, this very powerful, short-lived movement?
I think one of the big reasons that feminism has forgotten them is because we have forgotten their anti-work politics. So when we think about what did they want to do, we have read them as wanting to be housewives.
Now, did they foreground their role as mothers as a political legitimation or not?
They did at times, yes. One of their slogans was mother power, and they were involved in Coretta Scott King's Mother's Day mobilization. And they certainly did frame some of their demands in terms of the need to take care of their children. We can look at that maybe more as a strategic move, right? This is a sort of subjectivity of motherhood to which people were entitled to some benefits because those are the only people who were entitled to welfare, right? You couldn't necessarily get it as a single person. So they sort of use this respectability of motherhood or the state's putative appreciation for motherhood as a means to access these funds. But we have forgotten that this was not the end. This was not their end objective, right? This was a means to an end to them, which was the political work.
And what happened to the movement?
Fran Piven and Richard Cloward, right, were really involved in this, and they wrote extensively about why this movement declined, and they use it really as an example of why movements decline in general. And their explanation of this was that they became overly focused on maintaining an organization, so maintaining this national welfare rights organization, which, you know, had a big budget and many offices and a big staff, and in doing so and becoming so obsessed with maintaining this organization, they forgot about what their real power was, which was, as you point out, their ability to engage in really militant disruption, right? And I think that this is a critique that a lot of people have of what has happened to the labor movement and other kinds of social movements is that we become so invested in maintaining an organizational structure that we then are too afraid to throw that into danger by engaging in the actual thing that gives us power, which is being bad.
Yeah, Jane McAlevey's mentor, Jerry Brown, not the governor, but the head of the 1199 New England, used to say that the strike is like a muscle. You have to exercise it or it'll atrophy. And everyone seems to have forgotten that lesson.
My union, not least of all.
So what can we learn from this, you know, like 40, almost 50 years later, that is relevant to today? I mean, it seems like such a relic in so many ways, like the idea of a generous welfare state in New York City or in the United States seems like almost otherworldly. But what organizationally, ideologically, politically can we learn from them?
Vis-a-vis this question of anti-work politics, I think they have a number of important insights. I think that they provide an important lesson to us, especially as we're sort of involved often in this question of full employment or UBI, right? They offer us an important case study of a working class movement that was existing at a time where full employment was really the resonant current and that they rejected this, right? They conceived of a different kind of way forward that was really predicated on a critique of work. And especially that the sort of negative things that we think of when we think of work aren't sort of ancillary to it, aren't things that we can do away with, but that actually are really constitutive of waged labor in general. And I think that that's one of their biggest insights. Certainly the emphasis on militancy, on disruption. And, you know, one of the things that Fran and I try to flesh out in this article that we wrote is also that they had, I think, a really forward-thinking, kind of almost maybe what second-wave feminists would have called a pro-sex politics, right? A real assertion of the importance of women's autonomy and women's desire, right? That they shouldn't be beholden to a man or to a job for their well-being, right? That they wanted genuine autonomy or a kind of positive freedom, right? Not just a negative freedom.
They were not embarrassed about their sexuality.
No, I mean, they had to be really vocal about the fact that they had the right to have boyfriends and they had the right to have sexual lives in ways that were somewhat deviant, although at the time becoming somewhat less deviant, because they weren't married or, they had children with someone else. And I think that this is also maybe a lesson that I take from them is that not all of them had this kind of pro-sex approach where they were like talking about their boyfriends raucously at these big conferences. A lot of them were really religious but they had this kind of ability to hold a kind of diversity of opinions, right? That we don't all have to be on the same page about this. What is really fundamental is fighting for the ways that we have more autonomy in our lives. And if that means like, you want to have more boyfriends or you want to have more time to go to church, like those are all valid desires and uses of your time. One of the lessons that I think that the welfare rights movement especially offers us in this conversation around anti-work politics is a retort to this kind of condescending way that anti-work politics are framed by a lot of critics of it, which is, that grad students just sort of fantasize about being able to spend their days in coffee shops, or they have this fantasy that everyone is going to become a philosopher king. And the welfare rights activists have very clear ways that they're not sort of fancy grad students who want to spend their days in coffee shops in onanistic pursuits, right? They envision their contributions to society as being really valuable and being enabled via a wage, but that they don't want the intrusion of the state sort of calculating or surveying what exactly they're doing with their days, right? They want genuine autonomy, and they envision that autonomy as allowing them to do really important things.
And this is a very stigmatized group that didn't really get too apologetic.
No,
they really like fought back.
Yeah, yeah. And that's been hard. I think that's been hard for historians in recent years following the attacks on welfare in general, that we have sort of all gone on the defensive of really trying to reassert the ways that they were respectable and that they were good and that they are cohesive with general American values, when in fact they were very, very bold and very radical in their demands and in their visions of what they wanted for their lives.
That was Wilson Sherwin, a grad student at CUNY, who's writing a dissertation on the welfare rights movement of 50 years ago. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Pressure Suit by Adult from 1999. Next, Brazil. Jair Bolsonaro, a frightfully reactionary politician, will become president of Brazil on January 1st. How is the left preparing for this dreadful event? Here are Marta Sola Cabral, an activist based in the city of Salvador, the capital of the state of Bahia in northeastern Brazil, and Forrest Hilton, a historian who teaches at the National University of Colombia in Medellin, to talk about all that. We've been giving Forrest a pretty heavy workout lately, but there's a lot of news coming out of that part of the world. Marta Silva Cabral and Forrest Hilton. Marta, what is happening in the resistance to Bolsonaro? He's going to be taking office in, 3 weeks, and it's a terrifying prospect. What are people doing to prepare for this onslaught?
Yeah, it's interesting because there are two perspectives. The perspective of the people who voted Bolsonaro and the perspective of the left-thinking people it's very interesting to see that the people who voted Bolsonaro are very full of hope that something really is going to change. And all these scandals about corruption and everything that's happening, it's a week and then the other week another one and the other week another one, but the people are like, no, but it's okay. We have to wait to see if something, because he would do something to change this situation. So they are blind. The left thinking people are really afraid. Very interesting point that we are living now. We are paralyzed. This is the thing. We are really paralyzed.
I don't want to import my American model imperialistically, but you know, there's parallels with Trump, and the people who supported Trump were a mix. People who really liked his nationalist, racist, reactionary, xenophobic line. And then there are some people who just thought he would shake things up, who weren't necessarily on board with the full agenda, but you know, just looking for something to change. I assume there's something like that behind Bolsonaro as well. So what's the mix? I mean, how much of it is people who really support this right-wing fascist politics versus how many people are just looking to shake things up?
The Brazilians are not up to shake the things. We are not this kind of people. The Brazilians are really passive, but they are not fascist. It's complicated because they didn't vote Bolsonaro because they have this kind of fascist thinking. They voted really because they wanted to change the things. I don't know, power alternance?
Alternation in power.
Yeah, alternation of power. Or they can say lots and lots of things, but you can't identify in these people that they are fascists. The traces of fascism, you can't identify in these people. But Bolsonaro was elected because of really a desire, a deep desire of change, not because the people are fascist here. You know, because who voted for him was really the people of the streets and this kind of people that really don't know what fascism is.
And so similar to the United States, a lot of people just fed up with a certain status quo and seeing no alternative, right, vote for the right-wing strongman. Plenty of people pulled along by the current or the wave.
The status quo that people were so dissatisfied with. So Temer's government was, you know, transitional. But leading to Temer, there must have been mounting disappointment with what the PT did. You know, the PT certainly had a lot of accomplishments in power, but by the end, there was an economic crisis, political crisis. What is responsible for this sense of disappointment in the PT? What did the PT do that gave rise to this sense of disappointment and frustration?
A lot of things changed in the society. They can identify the place that where they went before. Now they are thinking like a middle class. And so as the middle class, they have other agendas, other desires, and these desires and these things are really connected to the middle class. Como uma projeção do...
Projection.
Yeah.
The PT created a certain degree of social mobility through the educational system, but once people achieved middle-class status or imagined themselves to achieve middle-class status, their whole ideological horizon changed.
They didn't want to be workers anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
But then also the Brazilian upper classes were very annoyed. You know, even though the PT was hardly a revolutionary government, they were still annoyed by these reforms and... increased assertiveness by the working classes. How does this new aspiration of this new middle class or this identification that the middle class has with people above them, how does that work with the discontent of the upper classes? I mean, are they sort of seeing eye to eye on this and want the fascists to shake things up?
We have here the upper classes are the sons and the grandsons of the upper classes of, I don't know, 300 years ago. So they are the same families of the colonization process, and so these things are repeating and repeating and repeating. And the middle class just want to be them. They feel comfortable to see themselves in the upper classes, so they want to reproduce the thinking of the upper classes.
That upper class you describe sounds like agricultural.
Yeah.
Is there an industrial, a capitalist class, a capitalist industrial upper class?
Yeah, we have this, but... The upper classes here in Brazil are the descendants of the upper classes of 400 years ago. they are the owners of the power, really. We don't have here an industrial upper classes. It's not so developed like this.
They're the heirs of a colonial plantation society, right?
Yeah. Coffee, cotton, and here in Northeast, where we are right now, the sugar cane. Brazil was born because of this agricultural process.
Yes, so we're talking about a deeply reactionary social formation.
Yeah, very reactionary.
Very reactionary, an incredible degree of continuity in an oligarchic ruling class that you only find in a country like Colombia. There's not that many countries where you can see this degree of oligarchic continuity. And the 50th anniversary, the coup in 1964, which, right, everybody is thinking about and discussing, when the middle classes in Brazil similarly identified with the oligarchy, when there was actually a genuine alternative to that type of politics, and that's what led to the military dictatorship in 1964.
Land reform is an important part of that, right? And that's what the discontent was?
Yes, and especially where we are here in the Northeast. Peasant leagues and land takeovers. There were urban intellectuals that were involved in these rural processes of redistributing wealth and power. And even though it was actually quite moderate, it was sufficient to terrify the landed elites of Brazil. And with the help of the United States and the Brazilian military, they were very good at building middle-class support for this kind of semi-fascist military dictatorship. There is just a terrifying sense right now of the return of all that.
Bolsonaro trades on a nostalgia for that coup, right?
Yeah, that's true. We are a little bit afraid, but I don't think that something like this can happen right now because eu estava falando para você ontem sobre segurança jurídica.
Because of issues of judicial security.
Of the democracy. They want to protect the second biggest democracy of the world.
They need a democratic face. They can't go into military dictatorship mode. It won't work, and they kind of know that.
Let's talk some about the resistance to Bolsonaro. You were involved in organizing a large feminist demonstrations against him. Gender and domestic relations, that sort of thing, is really important to right-wing politics. It's really not a peripheral issue at all. It's very central. So how are you framing opposition to this regime from that point of view?
Before the elections, was really easy to be against Bolsonaro. Right now, for us, it's really big how we are going to do this, because we are really afraid.
You're afraid of the state repression, or are you afraid of other people, his supporters?
We are afraid of state repression. I was... tive ameaça de morte.
She received death threats.
And I had protection for the police, personal protection for the police because of that. So, and it was before he was elected. Can you imagine right now for us? We are thinking about acting in other ways, coming back to the bases, coming back to the poor people and act with them, with social formation and political formation, information, you know, with these people to build a few things.
So I think Martha's saying that they've got to go back to the grassroots and get back to sort of basics in terms of political education in the poor and peripheral neighborhoods, which the PT really overlooked in a certain way. That wasn't part of their emphasis as much as they did for education. They really didn't do a lot of sort of political, ideological, and cultural work in the neighborhoods in a grassroots way, which obviously would have strengthened them in order to be able to resist better the onslaught of Bolsonaro. So what I think I hear Martha saying is that the time has come to sort of return to the roots of, you know, where essentially the PT came from and get back to a certain kind of grassroots organizing that perhaps is not as visible in public terms, so that people are at once doing grassroots organizing and trying to keep low profiles about it.
Now, are you talking about rural or urban, grassroots or both?
Both, yeah.
Bolsonaro's strength is in the cities, right?
Yeah, but it was also in the countryside, yeah. We can't divide this kind, because it was a really interesting phenomenon. And here in Bahia, we had people voted for PT, for here, for the government, for the government of Bahia, and they voted Bolsonaro for the government of Brazil.
People who did that, what do you think they were thinking?
Because they are tired of corruption. They are tired of living in a country without security. And it was the two big flags of Bolsonaro, the fight against corruption and the public security.
And these are both very real things, right? I mean, the level of crime and murder is enormously high, and the corruption is also pervasive, right? They're not going after phantoms. These are real issues. It's just that it doesn't seem that Bolsonaro is going to be able to do much about them.
Yeah. And we had also this boom of affirmative actions, public politics for the LGBTs and black people and women and everything. And this, there was a wave of conservative thinking after this. We are a very conservative country, and we were born with this idealistic thing of family, really strict kind of family as an ideal thing. So the people were afraid of this country became really a very open place to all the things can happen. I think you can understand what I'm talking about, sexually thinking and everything. This kind of conservative thinking is really strong here now. They are, I don't know, I never seen this in 20 years. I am 35 today, but I never seen this in 20 years that it's really unbelievable what's happening here.
The evangelical Protestant churches are a very important part of that reaction, aren't they?
Yeah, I think. It's a mix of all this stuff, you know? The conservative thinking, politics of security against drugs, against this, and then you have also the fight against corruption because the people are feeling betrayed, like the PT betrayed them. As a worker party, the PT betrayed the people with corruption. So they are also like vengeance, you know? They are searching for vengeance against the PT.
That was the voice of Marta Silva Cabral, an activist based in Salvador, Brazil. I'm speaking with her and Forrest Hilton, who teaches at the National University of Colombia in Medellin. What you described, this, you know, promoting LGBT rights, promoting women, dealing with racial discrimination, racial hierarchy, these are challenges for left parties around the world, it seems, that they, you know, provoke these horrible reactions, yet we don't want to give this up because, you know, there's an important part of human development, human liberation. But they do cause this kind of backlash. How do we work with this you know, this sense of social conservatism that among much of the working classes? I mean, is there a way to make progress in those kinds of social areas without alienating the people who you know, are supposed to be our base on the left?
We know now that we are, I don't know, 200 steps back after this happening of Bolsonaro here in Brazil. It's a new kind of construction. We are coming to the schools, to the liderança comunitária.
The grassroots community leaders.
Yeah. And the football teams, this is the soccer clubs, this is very important. We are building very fast in Brazil, I don't know, like two months ago, this was a boom. There was a boom of anti-fascist brigades into the supporters of the football teams here in Brazil.
So the soccer fans are forming themselves into anti-fascist brigades in some cases.
And this is very interesting because we were like, I'm part of one here of my soccer team, Bahia, here in Bahia, okay? And we started this in 1 week. We had lots and lots of followers at the social media. So we are building a lot of affirmative actions to get inside the football, because football for me is how the people think really here in Brazil. There's no thinking of people that it's not going through football, and we have to be inside of this, and we have to take the information for the people and bring all the things that Forrest talked about like a few minutes ago, and we are trying to do the communities.
And this applies to women, too. Women are as deeply into football as men are?
Yeah. But I am deeply into football. I lived in Europe for a few years. I worked with football. I worked with big events like World Cup and also the Olympics. And I'm really into sports.
So Mantha's saying that going through these like sports teams, fan clubs, right, the fans, is a surefire way to actually reach people, the people that you want to reach, and that through these sort of anti-fascist fan activities, you can actually do grassroots organizing in the neighborhoods where the fans live. So Martha's saying that she really sees soccer as a sort of cultural arena that has to be won for the left. And she's saying the PT wasn't really thinking along those lines all those years in power. I was thinking about how to govern, of course. And now it's, of course, deeply necessary to win a whole lot of these people over to anti-fascist perspectives. But the way to do that is by being involved with soccer fans.
Yeah, their activities, not just soccer, but all their activities. Really, the people activities, not the academic activities, but with the people, in the middle of the people. You know?
So there's a widespread critique here in Salvador that I've heard from a number of people, is that the PT was just too rooted in a kind of university intellectual culture. And, of course, as somebody who comes from the desert of the United States Academy, for me, it's remarkable the kind of intellectual, cultural, and political renaissance in Brazilian public universities. But from the perspective of people here on the ground, that's actually a problem because it's almost as if they enclose themselves in these university spaces and the kind of grassroots organizing and building bridges between, say, the university intellectual culture and then popular culture was kind of neglected in all those years the PT was in power. So this is something I've heard from Marta and others. I guess the cultural dimensions, you know, popular culture, where people are at and how you can reach them, have become sort of much more urgent questions that people are trying to address. And I guess these anti-fascist activities involved with the soccer fan clubs is something that's really taking off. And in an event that we did yesterday at the university about how to build a broad anti-fascist front in Brazil, somebody from the military police was there, and he participated in the event. He's an intellectual, of course, and a student of history, but it was very interesting to hear his perspective as somebody who's in the military police. He represents an anti-fascist democratic current within the military police, which is also growing. The sense in which there are spaces where these people are, for instance, the military police or soccer fan clubs, where it is possible to win people over to anti-fascist perspectives. And that's what this guy from the military police was saying. He's saying if we can get beyond some of the left intellectualism that has become so ingrained with the PT in power so long, we can actually win over people in the military police to a much more democratic politics. And he's said this as somebody who has, you know, spent his career in the military police. So I find all this very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, but would it get to the point where they would defy orders to shoot people?
Well, that seems to be what he's trying to tell the left. He was essentially trying to tell the kind of university and intellectual left that this has to be part of any broad anti-fascist front and alliance because we're already organized. We are already doing this work among our colleagues, and we kind of only need for the left to recognize that we exist, that we are doing this work, and that this work is also important.
What about Bolsonaro? Will he be capable of governing, or, you know, is this, he's going to find that his promises were way too grand and he can't actually bring them to fruition?
I believe that Bolsonaro is just a figure, you know, like, I believe there are really other interests and other people behind his government.
Who is that behind him? What are the forces behind him?
The upper classes, the oligarchies, and the aristocracy, and he was a really nice figure for that. His speech, it was really important for his election, you know?
His whole discourse.
Yeah, the discourse. He was always like a simple man and without this, como é que eu posso dizer, floreios acadêmicos.
Yeah, he doesn't have any of this kind of flowery academic language. There's none of that with Bolsonaro. And he played on that as much as he could.
It worked.
What are his priorities? What do you think he wants to get done, you know, early in his term in office?
I think, Doug, he wants to do nothing. He don't know what he's doing there. He couldn't realize what he's doing there right now. I think he's there just because they need a figure, and I don't think that Bolsonaro is thinking about what he's doing.
So what do the people behind him want to do then with his, you know, when he takes office?
Privatizações.
Continue with the privatization program. There's a whole lot of public wealth left to loot and privatize.
And clear cut the Amazon?
Clear cut the Amazon.
Yeah, of course. This is the first thing. I think this is the first thing. And we have all this talking about war with the other communist countries here in South America, like Venezuela and blah, blah, blah. So.
Yeah, so how serious is this that they're going to join with Colombia in an alliance against Venezuela? Is that likely to happen?
What do you think, Forrest?
It's hard to say. Bolsonaro obviously wants to get in good with Trump, and this is really, really important to him. He wants to be Trump's man in South America, and that's what Trump wants as well. There could be repercussions in terms of commercial relations with China, right? I mean, it's one thing for the United States to declare a trade war with China. It's really another thing entirely for Brazil to do the same thing because the United States is doing it. So Bolsonaro sort of talks about these things, but as with Trump, it's not clear always that he, in fact, understands the potential consequences of certain policies. But I wanted to add, Doug, that we talked a lot about Duque in Colombia as this sort of figurehead. They couldn't really come up with anybody else because of how far to the right the political spectrum had shifted in general. And they came up with just a figurehead who they thought, in the case of Colombia, would be able to govern. And Duque in Colombia has really been remarkable for his inability to govern so far. And just yesterday, he was defeated by students and professors who were on strike for 65 days and won 10 times more money than the government was willing to cough up initially. So Bolsonaro is also just this figurehead, doesn't really have a clear idea of how he wants to govern, other than sort of ultra neoliberal economic measures, which can only deepen the economic crisis, can't possibly alleviate it.
Yeah.
And it's also hard to see how, with deepening privatization, lowering of tariffs, opening of markets, clear cutting the Amazon, the spread of sort of monocropping soy agriculture, it's not really clear how any of that is going to solve people's economic problems. If anything, it's going to make them worse. And it's not clear that that's going to make corruption go away, right? We know that it's only likely to add to the levels of already aberrant corruption. Also, the issue of delivering true security so that people don't feel unsafe, it's very hard to see how that's going to happen in a context where the economy is essentially unwinding.
Well, is he going to unleash death squads, Duterte style?
Yeah. Okay, we have the paramilitary power here. It's like a parallel organization. Inside the legitimated power, we have this parallel organizations, militias here.
So they're kind of like paramilitary formations.
I don't know what it's going to be in the future. Really don't know. I think we were talking a little bit before this interview, and we were talking about the professionalization of this. You know, they are coming professional. And I don't think they are going to be death squads.
From the outside, for something far away from Brazil, I mean, it sort of looks like some kind of Hitler will be taking power in a few weeks. Is that an exaggeration, or should we be thinking along those lines?
I was thinking about it was like a Hitler, Brazilian Hitler, but now I see him as too stupid to be a Hitler.
Well, you know, Hitler had an organization and agenda and all kinds of things, and within weeks, you know, it was like putting people in jail and completely transforming Germany. But you don't see that Bolsonaro has the personal or institutional resources to do that in Brazil?
No, I don't think so.
And Doug, in an earlier interview you did on Brazil, the commentator pointed out that Bolsonaro has never succeeded at anything in his life.
Never.
He's not a successful legislator. He's not even a successful fraudulent businessman. The guy's got nothing whatsoever going on. So in that case, it might be difficult for him to govern. And the problem for ruling blocs, even if they're sort of flirting with fascism, is that you do need actually a Hitler to run things. It's hard to do fascism with no one able to run anything.
Well, I mean, that's the thing with watching Trump here, you know, like he would like to be that kind of strongman, I think, if he could, but he just doesn't have the skills or, you know, the depth of talent working with him to run the kind of authoritarian regime he would like to.
Yeah, so there's a certain overreach in terms of ego that's really not in consonance with any actual capacity. It's mostly fantasy.
Those are Marta Silva Cabral and Forrest Hilton. Marta is an activist based in Salvador in northeastern Brazil, and Forrest teaches history at the National University of Colombia in Medellin. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go at this, a gem from 40 years ago, Nick Lowe's Little Hitler. Till next week, bye.